welcome to all of you. Good evening. I'm Maureen Lamb, the facilitator for this call tonight. Greetings to all of you who have come together as we gather around our out-of-network campfire. We toast some marshmallows and listen to four of your fellow advocates talk about some surprise medical bills. And I can tell you for sure, even before we hear all about these cases, that these bills are definitely not a good kind of surprise and for the people that receive them, and they're in actually quite stressful. And we had talked about different laws that governed surprise medical bills in our call in January, and this is definitely a very hot topic and been getting a lot more press lately. I just happened to see the latest issue of Time magazine, and Rick Pugash had also mentioned this to me, that there's an article on this very same topic about surprise medical bills and out-of-network care. And so you may want to check it out. It's called You Only Think You're Covered. So it's a pretty apropos title for this topic. So we are very fortunate tonight to have four Alliance members speaking on our call about out-of-network care bills. We have Lisa Berry Blackstock, Lori Gardner, Rick Pugash, and myself will be sharing cases about some out-of-network bills. And we've received several questions from our members, and we'll try to get to them as many as we can possibly later in the call. We are going to try to get as much as we can talked about and discussed tonight and wrap up around quarter of eight. So, let's see. So I would like to just do brief intros of our speakers this evening, and then we'll have our advocates present in alphabetical order. So that will be Lisa, Lori, myself, and finish with Rick. So first I'd like to give a brief intro of Lisa. Hold on one second, sorry. Lisa Berry Blackstock. Her company is Soul Sherper and provides all aspects of patient healthcare advocacy to clients from the wealthy to the needy throughout the United States and with offices based in Southern California and Northern Nevada. Lori Gardner, her company is HealthLink Advocates Incorporated, and they provide patient navigation services to those patients in the greater New York and New Jersey area and partner with them to ensure they obtain the best possible healthcare. And Rick Pugash from Health Navigate LLC. It's a nationwide health benefits consulting and representation in health plan issues and appeals, and service is provided to Pennsylvania residents in all other health advocacy matters. And yours truly, Maureen Lamb. I'm with Medical Bill Support LLC, and we navigate the medical billing maze for our clients throughout the United States. So that's all of our advocates that will be speaking this evening. And if it's okay, Lisa, I'd like to invite you to our campfire. And if you want to present your first case, your case tonight, that would be terrific.
Okay. Thank you, Maureen. Just so I know, how much time do you want us to use to present our case? Because I realize we've got four presenters and we want to leave time open for Q&A. So what's the recommendation?
Approximately 5 minutes to present your case and leaving about 5 minutes for questions.
Okay, great.
As a general guideline. And Rick and I talked about the fact that if this generates a lot of interest and we really just can't get all the information and questions answered in tonight's call, that we'll do a follow-up. This is kind of a new approach for us, and so that's what we thought we'd try that tonight.
Okay. Well, so this is Lisa Blackstock in Los Angeles area. The case that I'm going to talk about is from a local client who came to me with an emergency room bill that was incurred by her minor daughter who fainted at home, hit her head, was taken to the local ER by ambulance. They did a CAT scan and x-rays on her back, and everything showed that it was negative, so they let her home, let her go home, and it, you know, they just kept an eye on her. There was no loss of consciousness, so it was a fall, and they wanted to take precautions, and they did so. And this woman was the guarantor of the bill on behalf of her daughter, and the bill came out to, I think it was about $9,000. They processed it through their insurance company, which is one of the ACA policies. The ACA policy did not pay any of it, but what they said in their explanation of benefits was that the cost for the services that were rendered at the hospital, and this is specifically the ER bill that I'm talking about and not the doctor bill and not the ambulance bill, that bill they thought was worth 50% of what they charged. And as a result, the hospital said to the woman, we'd like your 50%, your $4,500. So the woman reached out to me, explained the situation. She told me that her daughter was in the hospital for about 2 hours, and she didn't understand, you know, the level of care that was required since there was no loss of consciousness. She said the doctor spoke with her for about 1 minute. No prescriptions were needed. So I told the woman I would see what I could do. I was pretty sure I could get it knocked down just because the charge master is so inflated. But I didn't think I'd end up getting the bill entirely written off, which is what happened. And this is why. I requested the bills from the hospital. The appropriate HIPAA releases were signed. I obtained all of the records. I found out that the level of care that was administered in the ER was incorrectly registered. They categorized it on the billing as a level 4, which is, if people are not aware, there are 5 categories of emergency room visits, 1 being the most minor and 5 being the most serious. And the nurse's note said that the patient was admitted, she was conscious, she was coherent. I just didn't think that it reflected the billing accurately. So I called someone from the hospital, someone in their billing department, got their name, always get names, always follow up in writing so I have a written record. And this woman, I explained to her what I wanted to do, and she said, okay, that's fine. Just send us your HIPAA release, tell us what you want to do, and give us a couple of days to process it and call back. Well, when I called back, it turned out that the woman was no longer working at the job, and I was informed that the account had been turned over to collections, which I didn't think was fair. And at that point, I sent a letter to the hospital saying, not only did you overcharge my client in all likelihood, but you violated her fair credit rights. And we're supposed to be negotiating this case, and it was turned over to collections. And because you did not show good faith, I want it written off. So it got to the point where an attorney from the hospital called me, asked me what the situation was about. I explained it to him, and I said I just didn't really think that there was any excuse that a customer be treated like that. He said he would look into it and call me back, and he never did. And in my experience, that's code for they're just going to let it go, and they don't want to talk to you anymore, nor do they want to acknowledge it in writing. So I never heard from the attorney again, and my client never received another bill. So that's my story.
Wow. It's amazing.
I love it.
That's great.
Right. Terrific.
That's great. Lisa, I'm just curious, who did you actually contact at the hospital when you wrote the letter?
I sent it to the billing person, the toll-free number.
Really?
But after, apparently, I don't know if she quit or if she was let go, but once that didn't happen, or once I figured that out, then I kicked it up to the president and the CEO of the hospital.
Okay.
And because it is a local hospital, I know who that person is. I also happen to know that person has no business in that job, but that's just the way it goes. That has to do with the corporation that owns this particular hospital and the fact that this person was taken under the wing of someone who was promoted within the company. So, and she just, that person just turned it over to counsel who I dealt with.
Interesting. Great. Fantastic.
I have a quick question. This is Anne Rose Bishop. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Sure.
And,
hi.
Lisa, when you didn't hear back from the attorney and from the hospital, just there was no more communication, was your client's credit score affected at all?
No, because that was another thing that I told them in the letter, that when I was prepared to take them to small claims court, and where I live, the county in which this occurred, the limit is $10,000. So I was trying to, recover the $4,500 plus my fee, so the client wouldn't have to pay anything. But it was within that letter, I also stated that one of the things I wanted was a clear credit report. I have dealt with this before where credit agencies can go back and remove a negative rating. But in this case, it never happened.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa, I have a question. This is Michelle Riddle from Arizona. We met, probably back in October. Yeah. So when you didn't hear from the hospital, there was no more communication, no more billing. Was there a receipt that said there it was a negative balance?
Nothing.
A negative balance or nothing?
Nothing. And I'd like to hear from our other colleagues who are going to talk about this. My experience has been that when I know I've succeeded, I never hear anything, and neither does the client. So I'd be interested in knowing what other people's experiences are, but this has been the case for me from, a few thousand dollars all the way up to six figures. And the only reason that I can think that that's happening is because the hospital doesn't want to set a precedent. They don't want anything in writing. They don't want any documentation that this has been done, that this accommodation has been made, and that's why there's no record. I don't know what other people's experiences are. I'm interested to hear, but this is my experience.
So this is Martine. So are you saying you don't have a zero balance statement?
That is correct. There is no statement. And when I check back with the hospital and with the credit agency, there's nothing. It's gone.
So without a zero balance statement, they can come back for the next 7 years.
Okay. Well, I'm prepared for them if they do.
But what I do sometimes when I cannot get one. There's an automated system that you can sometimes access, and one of the prompts says, send me an itemized statement. And so it's an automated system, and then they just spit out, an itemized bill and mail it. That's what I use. Sometimes it works.
Okay. I always have the itemized statement, but when I go back and use the same account number, it's not recognized. So I think it's been taken out of the system and just written off.
That's
but
right.
In the event it's not, I always tell my clients that I'm available if any future issue would arise, and I'm confident enough with my own documentation and speaking with counsel on the other end that I can. I mean, I'm comfortable representing a client whether it's now or 7 years from now. But this is, I've been doing this for 27 years, and I've never had an issue where anybody's ever come back.
Yeah. No, if you can't find the account number, that means
I do, but it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't exist in the system.
It's been deleted from the system.
Interesting.
Yeah. Great. Well, Lisa, that was a fascinating case. Thank you.
No problem.
Interesting. Great job for your client. Fantastic.
So, Laurie, I wonder if we could ask you to present your case to us.
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you, Maureen, for having me into the campfire.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with you all tonight. I hope I can share some good information. I'm in, as Maureen said in the introduction, I'm in New Jersey and New York. So I use as my framework some really great news that New York had. They put the New York State surprise law went into effect on April 1st, 2015. So that really protects our clients quite a bit from these surprise bills. And New Jersey has legislation, but as we can guess, they're a little bit held up by the New Jersey Medical Association right now. And it was supposed to pass last fall, but I do hear that the sponsors have asked the stakeholder groups to try and come up with some reasonable revisions. So we're hoping we get a passage of a similar bill to New York State soon. So what I'm going to present tonight is one of my favorite cases, a delightful 28-year-old young lady who had a really complicated cancer and was being treated at a major Manhattan hospital. And she, her primary oncologist could not determine the source of this cancer. She had sent it for pathology at her institution, obviously, and came back undifferentiated, could not find the cause or the source of this cancer. So what she did was send this out. Well, I should back up and say that actually the client was employed by the city of New York, and she had an HMO plan. And, you know, she was covered at this center, the provider was covered. The provider decided that she needed some more information, certainly to try and find out what this pathology really meant. And she sent a pathology slide out for second consult at four different institutions. Well, at the time, you can imagine this 28-year-old young lady, her mom being a nurse, they're in crisis. They don't ask anything about this being out of network. The provider doesn't do anything. Out they go. Fast forward a month or two, and they get bills upwards of $12,000, $14,000 for these out-of-network pathology consults. So what I did is, you know, that's when they hired me. They called me and said, we're in trouble. We're in trouble on a lot of levels. We need, you know, we need medical help. We need insurance help. Mom's a nurse, but, you know, mom needs to be a mom. So the first thing I did, in particular with the out-of-network bills, was I got all the detailed bills. I pulled them together. They were from all over the country. So I did try and look up, you know, get some framework in terms of what the rules were, what the laws were in the particular states I was calling. I called each one of the institutions, got to their billing, and described the situation. There was a couple of bills that I had to go over pretty carefully. One was upwards, it was about $7,700. And when you look at it, it was pretty interesting because you knew something was up because there were 15 charges for $471 each. So I went through all the bills, and I did an accuracy check with the facility. I also said to them, listen, we're going to be working on this. Please put the account on hold because the last thing you want them to do, you know, like Lisa did, in good faith, this is being worked on with the insurance company, and to please put the account on hold. So the next step I did was call the insurance company just to say, here's what happened, exactly what I just told you. And without giving away any kind of HIPAA information, I basically said this was, you know, a surprise bill. And luckily for me, I got the right person on the phone and said, could we have a conference call with your supervisor? This is an extenuating situation. And I was pleased to know that they basically said, you know what, we're switching it right now from in-network or out-of-network to in-network. So all the coverage was washed, basically. So that was wonderful news. We did go on after that just as a follow-up because she still wanted to get a consult at MD Anderson and get a pathology consult there as well. But at that point, with me being involved and, like, all of you out there being involved, that we went through the right channels, or I went through the right channels into medical management to get pre-authorization to both get approval for her to go down and get a second opinion and for them to do a complete pathology consult. So all's well that ends well. I was happy and thrilled because this happens. I have a couple other stories, but I don't think we have time. But that's my story. And we can have great success for our clients. And now with more and more states, I think the last I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that 13 states possibly have these laws in place. You know, New York, I'm familiar with New York, New Jersey. I hope to have it in soon, but I think there are 12 other states.
I think there's more kind of tweaking the New York law. I don't think there any state is as complete as New York, but I think there's different provisions that some of the other states have. That sounds about right, around 13.
Yeah, which is
great news.
Maureen, this is Rick.
Sure.
I think the original law was passed in the spring of 2014, and then it took a year to do regulations. But in the fall of 2014, there was a conference call that insurance commissioners from 36 states in the land were on with their counterpart from New York. And everybody is really, really interested in this, and life gets a whole lot simpler for a whole bunch of folks who work at the regulator level when something like this finally gets in place on a broader basis. I don't think it's a bunch of dominoes that are just urging to fall, but I think there's a lot of momentum for this, and for one could not be happier.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing, Rick, is in New York, I know the Attorney General was looking at the other side of the coin? The other side of the coin is the doctors are up in arms that they're being handed this usual and customary charge, right? That is pretty low in their estimation. I'm not going to comment on that, but the Attorney General was looking at, I guess there was one company, I think it was, Rick, you may know, Igenix, and they kind of had the market share on creating this quote-unquote usual and customary charge, and the Attorney General actually flipped that over and said, okay, yeah, we're going to get a little more transparency into that aspect of this whole process, which, you know, obviously, the more transparency we have, the better we all obey.
Good stuff.
This is Catherine. What is the name of that law? I remember last year, and I haven't had it. I'm in Texas, and it isn't in place here, and I didn't remember what the name of the law was.
I think it's just the New York State surprise law.
It's the surprise medical bill law, right? It's the something surprise bills law.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I remember pulling something, but I didn't remember what it was all about. Okay. That's good.
You can check the Alliance website. We had a discussion in January about some of these laws and regulations, and I put some links up, on the website under the SIG, so you can check that out.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. I have a question. I don't know what you. I mean, this is the first time I've joined in one of these SIG ones, so I'm not sure how your procedure is.
Well, tonight we're going to have a few brief questions after each advocate speaks about their case. And then at the end, we have some questions that were sent into us that we'll try to answer, and other questions from people on the call. So unless it's related to Lori's case, if you don't mind waiting, we're going to try to get through.
No, that's fine. I sent in the question earlier.
Okay.
I just wasn't sure your format.
Sure.
Thank you for telling me.
Sure. No problem. Does anyone have any questions related to the case that Laurie just presented? Okay. Great job, Laurie. Boy, sometimes it really is all about finding that right person to speak to at an insurance company or a billing office, just as Lisa said as well. So your client was very fortunate to have you help her with that. So my case, I'm Maureen Lamb again. So this case was one of my more unique cases that I've ever worked on. It was actually one of my smallest cases, but it was sort of interesting to me with the circumstances surrounding it, so I thought I would share it tonight with all of you. So my client had gone to his in-network medical facility for a routine colonoscopy. He did his due diligence beforehand. Before the procedure, he asked the billing office if the lab, the providers, and the facility were all going to be in network for his insurance, and he was assured absolutely the whole procedure was in network, no worries. So, in fact, the facility where he had the procedure done, the website said they took his insurance as well. So after he had his procedure done, no surprise, he received his pathologist bill. And it was actually a lot more than what he expected. It was to the tune of $1,575 and priced
by his insurance company at the out-of-network rate. So all of the other bills he had received for the procedure were priced at the in-network rate. And so he was really baffled by this. So he called his insurance company, and he was told, sorry, but the pathologists were actually out-of-network for this procedure because of his particular insurance plan. And they only paid a little more than half of it. So that left him with a balance of $740. And he was just furious because he felt like he had done all the due diligence beforehand to find out if it was going to be all in network, and he had been assured that it was. So for a while, he kind of stewed, and he just ignored the bill. And then that tactic didn't work, and he received a letter from an attorney who was serving as a collection agency about 6 months after the bill was due. So he tried to resolve the issue on his own, and I'm sure a lot of advocates have heard this story before. He tried to write letters. He tried to call the right people. He ended up screaming at people, and that just got him nowhere, and it just actually made things worse. So when he finally contacted me, he told me he had been sued and had to go to court for this bill that was approximately a year and a half overdue, and he owed a little less than half on the bill, about $740, and he was due in court in 3 weeks on April 1st. And this was actually no April Fool's Day joke. It was only about 3 weeks away, so I had to really scramble to get this resolved. And I actually looked at some of the documents, and he was supposed to be in a courtroom with a jury trial, and I couldn't believe it for this amount of money that this was being that he was being sued for this amount. I was astounded. And he was, in addition to having to take a day off from work to go to court, the summons stated that he could potentially owe interest on the bill, attorney fees, and the cost of the actual lawsuit. So he was really, my client was very much beside himself and knew that he had to get this resolved pretty quickly. So I was able to talk to various people and had to move quickly. As I said, it was just 3 weeks away, this court date. And I spoke to the insurance company, and actually, yes, in fact, these particular providers were out of network for his particular insurance plan, and so that wasn't going to be negotiated through them. And so I had to go back to the billing office for the pathologist's office and speak to them. And they weren't very approachable in the beginning because they had been yelled at by my client, and they weren't happy about it. But when I explained to them that he really had thought it was all going to be in-network, he had seen it on their website, he had been assured by their office, by the facility office, that this was all going to be in-network, the in-network rate, they were agreeable to pricing the bill at the in-network rate, which brought it down to $114. And so if we had had more time, I would have gotten it all written off, but we had to get this done very quickly because we had to get a $0 balance statement to the attorney's office that had sued him, and to make this lawsuit go away, and just to have this all resolved so that he wouldn't have to go to court. So he was ecstatic. I was happy, and it was just kind of an interesting twist. I had never had a lawsuit on top of a bill before, so it was interesting. I think some lessons learned for my client, if I was to speak to my client again, and for all of us, I always say to clients when I speak with them is don't ignore a bill. It's really harder to deal with a collection agency afterwards. And especially to have to go to court over a bill. So, deal with it earlier rather than later. And if you're going to check on in-network versus out-of-network, really, of course, in an emergency room situation, you can't do this, but you really have to check with the billing offices as well as your insurance company. And my client had just spoken with the one facility office, and that really wasn't enough. And just, I think, the lessons learned, too, is if you're in this kind of situation, if a client has this sort of situation, call an advocate, because My client was clearly too upset to work on this on his own. He tried, and you really sometimes need an advocate and a neutral party to resolve the issue. So that's my case. I'd love to take any questions if anybody has any.
Hi, it's Ann Rose up here in the Bay Area. And
hi,
Maureen and Lisa. There's a trend there that the pathology labs are all out of network. Mm. Is this unique to pathology labs, or what do you think is going on with these pathology tests that are done for things like cancer and after a colonoscopy? And so how come it's out of network kind of across the board, at least just from these two cases, and then they were able to just switch it into in-network? Thank you for taking my question.
I think that's directed to Lori and not Lisa.
Hi. Yeah, and I think in general, I've seen many more pathologists, anesthesiologists, ER physicians, all out of network. And
yes,
it seems to be on the rise, and it's really problematic. I mean, I'm reading about people that are planning, potentially if they have to go to an ER, they've already seen that the ER closest to them, now this is nearly criminal in my mind, that the ER closest to them, the MDs, the physician network, is out of network for physician services, as well as pathology, and the one that is in network is 30 minutes away versus 10, and that's where they're going. There were stories of people doing that because they can't afford this out-of-network bill they know they're going to get. I have seen it over and over and over again. Interesting case in pediatrics, I got a call similar to yours, Maureen. They were taking them to court. Literally, they had him a court date maybe 5 months after he had utilization of services of a neonatal specialist in the NICU, and his wife had had twins. The short story is, you know, they had no idea. They checked everything, the hospital, the anesthesia, everything was covered. They didn't think to ask about the neonatologist should they need it. You don't always need that, right, in a birthing.
Right.
And
right.
They did need it, and they had an enormous bill. The guy couldn't afford it. It was, they're all out of network because it doesn't make sense for them to be in network. They're getting, in their mind, the usual and customary charge doesn't cover their costs anymore. So
okay,
it is.
This is Lisa. I just wanted to add this. It's my understanding that in the event that a provider or a facility is out of network, if there's something that presents itself as an emergency, by law, the Affordable Care Act states that they must accept that coverage as in network, an in network provider. That's part of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, this is Martine, and there's actually two ways to get both claims paid and both low payments reversed. The first one is the ACA plus AB1324, which are two federal laws that clearly state that when emergency services are rendered at an out-of-network facility by out-of-network providers, the insurance must pay all those claims at the in-network rate and not impose any liability on the patient higher than that would have been if both providers had been in network. So you have federal laws, actually.
That's right.
Second, there's another thing is, let's say, if these are not emergency services, right, so they do not fall under those federal laws, there's in the industry, which I will share with you. Again, it's not a law. It's not, you know, it's not written anywhere, but the insurance companies will abide by them. Aetna will abide by it verbally when you say it over the phone, so they don't have a record on paper. But I have used it over the last, you know, as a billing manager, I used it over and over again. It has always worked. And I did billing for anesthesiologists for 14 years. If you have a few conditions that I'm going to tell you right now, in this, you know, in your case, you can invoke or you can try and force the insurance by filing an appeal and saying that, first, the services rendered were medically necessary. so the anesthesiologist, the pathologist, right? These are medically necessary services. The services were ordered by the referring or the supervising physician, and if that physician is in network, then that, or you know, that gives you additional ammunition. The third condition is the facility is in network. So the patient went through the trouble of going to the right facility. The fourth condition is the patient had no choice in the matter. The patient did not hire that doctor. And the fifth condition is that, if you can show it, is that there's no in-network provider at that facility. And by law, by state laws, insurance must provide in-network providers of the, you know, the basic specialties at in-network hospitals. Like in California, it is actually a requirement. I recently won a case with the state of California when I proved that Blue Shield of California had a restricted network, and they forced Blue Shield to pay UCLA, an out-of-network provider, $25,000 because they basically, you know, they did not abide by licensing, insurance licensing laws. So again, medically necessary, ordered by an MD, not chosen by the patient, in-network facility, and no other in-network provider at that facility, and you will get those claims paid at the in-network rate.
That's great. Thank you, Martine. That's really helpful. Wonderful.
Sure.
Thank you. Well, at this point, I'd like to invite Rick to share his final story at our campfire tonight. Rick, if you're ready to partake with your case.
I have to tell you, Maureen, Lori, Lisa, I am jealous. You have spoken of your cases in the past tense. They all have happy endings. This is an ongoing case I'm going to talk about, and I have no idea how it is going to end. But it involves a 75-year-old, recently naturalized United States citizen, lives in Northern Virginia. Tried to do the right thing, enrolls in an HMO through the marketplace. Gentleman understands managed care. He has exclusively used network providers. He gets it. Weekday afternoon last June, he is emergency ground transported to his local community hospital. He was cast, observed, and the medical team basically discovered way more problems, well beyond the capabilities of the medical team, well beyond the capabilities of the facility. Now about 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, all the lights are out at the health insurer. Everybody's gone home, so there's no direction to be had there. The local cardiologist wants to get him to a tertiary center for the right kind of care. He makes arrangements for my client to be transferred to George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C. for emergency surgery by their head of cardiothoracic surgery. Medical objective, obviously, is to transfer this gentleman as quickly as possible without further risk to life and health. So the local medical team at his community hospital arranges for him to be transported to GW by helicopter. As they customarily do, they contacted the local air medical provider, which is based within 3 miles of the local hospital. Hospital bills, physician bills, referring hospital, receiving hospital, sail through just fine. Turns out the air medical company is out of network. $41,000 bill. For the trip, yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's premium gas that they use. $41,000 bill. The plan paid its member rate of $6,000. $35,000 balance bill. Hope this isn't too terribly life changing, sir. Have a nice day. So we get involved in the case, and typically What I like to do is look for soft spots. I like looking for the pathways out there where we can basically poke holes in insurers' position or come up with stronger position. The plan document is no help. Actually, let me stop there. Let's just do some terminology and make sure everybody understands. I say plan document. It can also be referred to as an evidence of coverage, a summary plan description, probably a couple of other things. It all basically means the contract between the plan subscriber and the insurer or the health plan. It is the contract that specifically specifies benefits, coverage, limitations, exclusions, and the rules. So I'm going to talk about plan document. This particular plan document has the usual benefit, out-of-network benefit, provided in emergency situations. It basically is limited to what went on in the hospital emergency room and with hospital emergency room physicians, and that is pretty much it. So not a whole lot of help on that front. The next thing I did was I started to dig as to why this particular air medical provider was used. And I went on a search through the online provider directory. I wanted to see air medical providers in network within a 50-mile radius of the community hospital. The first one I saw, and five names showed up. The first one gave me pause. The name of the first one was the Fredericksburg Fire Company. And I'm saying to myself, these folks are more likely to have a lunch truck than a fleet of helicopters. There's something wrong here. So I called them. And, of course, the listing was in error. So then I go on to the other four. And that was an error, too. None of the five listed were, in fact, air medical providers. So next step, I get back to the health insurer and try to find out what's going on. And, folks, I am not making this up. I was told, oh, yeah, that's the wrong list. Try this one. And they basically sent me a list of six other air medical providers. Here's the best part. Only one of them showed up in the provider directory. It is 95 miles away from the receiving hospital. And even more interestingly, it does not fly into the Washington, D.C. restricted flight zone. Sorry, can't use it. The other five, none of them show up in the provider directory. Why? Because they are 130 to 200 miles away, and the provider directory only goes up to a 100-mile radius. That's great. Let's see, what else? We have the helicopter of one company was deployed at the time, could not have been there for my client. Two other providers don't fly into D.C. because it's a restricted flight zone. One provider doesn't serve Northern Virginia, and the last one, Washington, D.C., is outside the 125-mile service area, the fifth provider. Long and the short of it, folks, is we have a very interesting situation on our hands. We have no network air medical providers that serve Northern Virginia. And the gentleman, wow. And the gentleman belongs to a qualified health plan sold through the marketplace, and this plan does not meet the basic network accessibility requirements of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That's big stuff. And that that has become one of our major arguments in our complaint to the Virginia Bureau of Insurance. We have some other arguments, too. The time doesn't really permit me getting into all of them. But now, once the arguments have been identified, the objective turns to how you win this thing. And the first thing a Department of Insurance will do when it gets a complaint against the health insurer is it will send a copy of that complaint to the insurer, because the insurer is going to have a certain amount of time to respond to it. What I often like doing in my complaints is raising questions that are either impossible or embarrassing for the insurer to answer. So one question that is going into this complaint is, hey, folks, if this situation occurred during normal business hours, give us the names of your plan medical directors who actually would have suggested to an attending cardiologist to use an air medical provider that is based 150 miles away to to transport a critically ill patient. Got any names? Anyone want to step forward? Second question. This transport request occurred in the evening when your offices are closed. How is anyone, a provider or the member, going to know who to contact if nobody shows up in your provider directory? Those are tough questions to answer. So stuff like that. The other consideration in all this is once you get to a Bureau of Insurance or a Department of Insurance level, you want to make sure that, or at least I want to try to make sure that they have the jurisdiction, or they feel they have the jurisdiction to be able to respond favorably to the complaint. Lori, if this took place in the state of New York, I would feel pretty comfortable that New York would basically be willing to really, really dig into the Affordable Care Act. And if there was a licensed entity that was not in compliance with a major provision, I really think they'd be inclined to step in. Other states in the land, I'm not so sure. And absent specific state law or regulation, some departments of insurance are just reluctant to use federal law, even if it is with an insurer that they have licensed, if there is no specific state statute. Fortunately, Commonwealth of Virginia has a law that was enacted in 1997. It is called Prohibited Practices, and I will just read quickly from it. No health maintenance organization may cause or knowingly permit the use of advertising that is untrue or misleading, solicitation that is untrue or misleading, any form of evidence of coverage that is deceptive. For purposes of this chapter, an evidence of coverage shall be deemed to be deceptive if it causes a reasonable person who has no special knowledge of health care plans to expect benefits, services, charges, or other advantages that the evidence of coverage does not provide, or that the health plan issuing the evidence of coverage does not regularly make available for enrollees covered under the evidence of coverage. In other words, you folks have basically failed fundamentally in the network you present to provide the full breadth of emergency services. Now this is something that the Bureau of Insurance in the Commonwealth of Virginia can absolutely positively legally hang their hat on. I would like to think, folks, that when this complaint is submitted and it will go in sometime this month, that we will have represented our client as strongly as possible, but you just never know in these things when you're dealing with regulators. But this has been a fun case.
Hey, Rick, this is Lori. That's exactly the statute I've taken a couple of cases with New Jersey Banking Department of Banking Insurance and been very successful on things that were less clear, more customer service types of filings and whatnot. And once they see something related to that, like there's some deception and it's documented really well that the member could not find the right listing or it was a little bit obscure or they didn't write something on the claim form, how long – at least in New Jersey, they've really ruled positively on those cases. So I hope yours goes that well.
You and me both. That's good stuff. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's great stuff. Wow. Fantastic. You've got to let us know how this turns out, Rick.
Fascinating. If you call me in the middle of May and I don't answer the phone, I've probably taken a header off of one of our Philadelphia to New Jersey bridges. I've already picked the one with the lowest tolls, but hopefully I'll answer.
Don't think like that. Think positively. Think positively.
I am.
That's fascinating.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I just went through the same thing that you just did your scenario of. I have the same exact story. CareFlight in Texas picked up this lady at Baylor Hospital. Their bill was $40,000. The plan that they have, I think United Healthcare, it paid $6,000 because they're non-network providers. This is the second one I've had. I filed with the state of Texas, and all they said was everything was handled correctly at the hospital. So I've tried the state, everything, and we didn't get anywhere. So my new approach, and I'm waiting to hear from it, is I filed with the Better Business Bureau as a complaint against this one particular Baylor hospital that they did not handle things in a timely manner. They had an ER team that kept her there for 2.5 hours. This lady was having an ectopic pregnancy, they sent her over. They sent him to the big Baylor, and they didn't give him directions on where to take her there. And so there's a couple other points addressed in my complaint with the Better Business Bureau against Baylor Corporate, and I'm waiting for the response back from them, because those were mistakes that the hospital made before they called the air ambulance, which had they done their preliminary work the right way, they could have taken a local ambulance and driven, you know, 15 minutes, just like your scenario, to the big Baylor hospital. But there isn't anybody in Texas. The only way you can get an air ambulance bill cheap is that I send it out to everybody. You pay $50 for a membership to CareFlight, and you get free rides the whole time.
I've seen that.
Wow.
Are there ambulance companies?
What?
Are there network air ambulance companies in Texas?
Not that I've found, and this is my second one like that. First one, I got nothing. They wouldn't even work with a student on reducing the payments of the $25,000 he owed because he had a motorcycle accident. Nope.
Is it a marketplace plan?
No. These are group plans.
Is it an ACA compliant plan?
It is. I think the one lady had a United Healthcare, and I don't know I guess it's through her employer. And the other one was last year. I think his may have been through the university. But
you might have an argument with the Texas Department of Insurance.
I talked to them. I said, why is this happening? Why can they get away with it? Because we cannot control doctors and providers. If we try to do that, and you know, we have more trouble than we have with what we're having right now. These are out of network. That's what they charge. That's what they get paid. That's it. There's nothing else to it. I did the same research and everything you did. I got on two cases. I got nowhere whatsoever. So my complaint to Baylor that this woman should have been. She was told when she went into this one Baylor hospital that they were moving to the new hospital. That's just another caveat, and that. They did not have an OB-GYN doctor there, and they did not have a gynecologist there. So my point is that they should not have admitted her there or done anything or kept her for 2.5 hours and then all of a sudden say, oh, well, we need a care flighter. You know, you have to look inside at what they're doing in the emergency room. And what I did was I had the lady – I've been doing this a lot on some of these big ones, problems I have. I have them put it in writing, everything that happened, and then I submit that with my complaint. And it's a little bit more viable to look at than to listen to me talk about what somebody did. But I haven't heard back. I filed the complaint February 8th with the Better Business Bureau. It has helped in some of these cases where they've stepped in. But I will see what happens on this one. But I think I'm hoping Baylor will lose because of the way that they handled the thing from the beginning. And that in one other case I had, to make a long story short, it was a big long scenario, and they had an expensive air operation, care flight type thing. And I talked to the hospital about it, and I said this wasn't right. And since the air ambulance was a provider and therefore a contractor with the hospital and had a contract, they went back and got rid of the charge for that helicopter trip. So I'm hoping Baylor will do the same for this lady that I filed the complaint for.
I wish you good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck.
We'll see what happens.
Well, thank
there's a lot of interesting good advice.
Great. Okay, I'd like
well,
to
I'm
add
just...
something real quick.
Sure, sure. Sure.
Yeah, this is Lisa. One thing that I've learned, I mean, since healthcare in its present form is so new, and there are a lot of things that aren't compliant, even though there's technically a law around it. One thing that I've learned from working with attorneys over the years as an estate administrator is you don't ask or request anything. You tell them what you're offering why. And you're not giving – I have found it very effective. If you have enough documentation to support a reasonable position, and obviously I don't recommend that any advocate take a case that is not reasonable, because that's not the point of what any of us do. But there is so much unreasonableness going on, and so few people with either the direct authority to make significant decisions or to, even understand a lot of what you're talking about. I found that it's very helpful to go in from the beginning and say, I don't think this is fair. This is why. This is what I'm proposing. If this isn't acceptable to you, then this is what I'm going to do. And that way you don't give them a chance to deny you.
Right.
Yep, for whatever that's worth. I've just
it's
found
the same
that
thing as a Better Business
helpful.
Bureau. That Better Business Bureau asks you, what's your complaint and what do you want from them? What do you want them to do?
Yeah, I mean, I just cut to the chase and say, look, this is who I am. This is who I represent. These are the facts of the case. This is where I think, an error has been made. And as a result, I would like to, present this as an option and, get back to me about this. So it's very specific. I think you can save yourself a lot of time and get right to somebody who can help you, because a lot of people answering the phones can't. And they
right.
don't understand the full depth of what we're dealing with when we take on a complaint like this.
Right. Great point. Yeah, always have to get to the right person in the bureaucracy, basically. You have to just escalate as much as needed to get to the right person that can help you, just like you're saying.